Welcome to More Than a Refresh. This is More Than a Refresh Presents Digital Privacy. Today, we have John Callis and Dan Fretchling. John, please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm John Callis. I'm technologist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I've done electronic privacy, security, cryptography for many years. I was one of the co-founders of PGP, founder of Blackphone, which was a security-enhanced Android phone, and I have been doing public policy for the last 5 years.
Dan?
Yeah, JD, John, honored to be here with both you guys. I'm Dan Fretchling. I'm CEO of Boltiv, and I found my way into privacy because I grew and sold my last cybersecurity company, and I had a very personal thing happen, which was my wife was diagnosed with cancer. And I noted as I was doing research, I was being profiled and targeted by all these shady cancer ads. And they were so pervasive that even after she passed away, I was still seeing them. So I wanted to do something about that. And that's how I ended up here at Boltiv, which helps combat those kinds of abuses.
All right. Hey, John, for those that don't know, and, you know, obviously being in the tech world, I've been an EFF fan for 30 years, but can you explain what EFF does, why it's important?
Sure. We are a civil liberties organization that is focused on digital rights. So we want to make it so that these same sorts of rights that you have in 3D real space, you have online as well. So that covers digital privacy. It covers all sorts of things. But that's kind of the thing that we work on.
And Dan, a little bit about Boltiv.
Yeah, so Boltiv, we're a for-profit company. We help other companies avoid inadvertent sharing of consumer data without consent. We find that all companies have leaks. Some are larger than others. The problem is privacy operations teams tend to be really lean, and they're in a sort of trust but can't verify method where they trust their systems work, but they don't always know if they really do. And that's where we come in. We find vendors leak private data about 25 to 50% of the time, most of the time unknowing.
Now, Dan, you mentioned in your intro, you know, one of the reasons that digital privacy is important to you, which was the inadvertent, or no, it was not inadvertent, I'm sure it was direct, tracking of you after a tragic event. John, I mean, co-founder of PGP, founder of Blackphone, I know what those things are. Can you go into a little bit of what those are for Dan, as well as our audience, and as well as why privacy is important to you, or why, even more so, why it's important for everyone? Because I think that the modern world, and especially the younger generations, truly do not understand why privacy is important.
Well, I think that privacy is important because it has become a commodity. And that's something that's happened in the relatively recent past. We use a lot of services on the internet and they're free. And it's good that they're free. I mean, it's good that you don't have to pay for Google. It's good that you don't have to pay for social media, that anybody who simply has a phone or a desktop computer can participate in things. It's a wonderful way to blunt what we would otherwise be complaining about with the digital divide. The issue is that we're paying for this with our information. And we don't know what it's being used for. We don't know where it's going. We also don't even really know if we're overpaying. And it is extraordinarily difficult for anybody to know what's really going on, particularly because of some of the things that Dan was talking about. There are organizations that their whole business is that they buy and sell information. And there are organizations that are accidentally leaking things that they should not be leaking. So that's one of the reasons why we need to protect that, is that all of the little things about us that can be used against us in any number of ways, from money manipulation, you know, selling you things that you don't need, to political manipulation, to on and on, are all going on. And in many cases, it's accidental and we just do not comprehend it. So it's wonderful that Dan is helping people understand what they're doing right and what they're doing wrong.
Hey, Dan, could you follow up on that?
Yeah, I like what John said, especially how you started talking about that what we think is free actually does cost us, and we may be overpaying with our privacy. I may steal that and use that line, John. I like that quite a bit.
Go right ahead.
But I think there is a commercial value of consumer data, and today's economy does run on data sharing, often without consent. About 80% or more of websites have trackers that collect user data, and retargeting, which is reaching back to the people who have expressed interest in a particular product or service, is the most efficient type of advertising on the internet on a cost per action basis. And that is very seductive and very tempting. And so we see trackers all the time, and we see this sometimes leads to abuses. This kind of profiling can lead to abuses. In one of the real kind of breakthrough ones was Cambridge Analytica, which everybody on this in this audience has heard of in 2018. Some of the more recent ones that have really started to snowball in 2023, the Sephora case, which was California's first settlement for $1.2 million for sharing data non-compliantly. The FTC has been really active first part of this year with settlements with three healthcare companies and an ed tech company and a child content gaming company. And where we stand right now, a couple weeks ago, Meta was fined, it was 1.2 billion euros for an ongoing series of abuses. So for as much as the commercial benefit is what that data represents, we're seeing a great reaction that began in 2018 with GDPR, and it's happening in the US in an accelerating rate with state laws and federal actions that is pushing back. And if you look globally, I think one of the stats that really tells me how fast this has grown is you have 75% of the world's population covered by data privacy laws right now. That number was only 20% back in 2020. Historically, there's never been a regulatory change that has simultaneously happened worldwide at this pace.
You know, I was actually having this conversation with an individual that I've known for years, and they said something that it irked me, but it really kind of I had a hard time outside of, but I have a right to respond. And it was, well, I have nothing to hide. Why do I care? Right? It's already all out there. What does it matter? So, John, can you, why is important? Why is digital privacy so actually important? What is the real life impact?
Well, that's kind of the nihilism thing. And there's two parts. I mean, one is the I have nothing to hide part, and you have something to hide. Everybody has something to hide. There are things that are as simple as, oh, where you live, where, you know, it's like we live in a world where there is dogpiling, doxing going on for taking relatively mainstream political opinions at the wrong time. So there's some degree of that that anybody can be surprised that they're thrown into that. So I'm going to say everybody's got something to hide. The other thing is that the real risks that we are doing are from the parts of the commercial world that are buying and selling information. And that information has a very short shelf life for them. They want recent information. They don't want to know what you were interested in a year ago because they're trying to use this to tailor ads and so on. They want to know what you did last week. And so if you say, I'm going to take care of my privacy, I'm going to start doing things, any action that you take today is going to take real world effect nearly immediately. And the information that they want is stale after about 3 to 6 months. So the nihilism is just not there. You can take control of your privacy at any time.
Okay. Producer just pinged me and asked me, and this is actually a good point. We kind of jumped right into this, and I think that there's an assumption because all three of us have some history and some experience in this. Let's take a step back and baseline this. Let's first define privacy and consent so people really because it's different with the internet, right? So John or Dan, do you want to take a shot at that? How would you define privacy and consent?
Well, I think being able to choose whether you grant consent for the use of your data is a new aspect of law and rules that hasn't always existed. The default has been a lack of choice. Our background is the internet. So that's what I'm going to speak to. And so actually having a choice, right? That is where we start to really define digital privacy, because if you can't choose whether you have something or not, it's a lot harder to define it. But the second part of what really is digital privacy is when you make a choice, feeling confident that companies are going to honor that consent. And whereas the problem prior to 2018 was you didn't have a choice, and I would argue in some cases we haven't totally solved that problem. The bigger problem that exists today is that companies don't always honor that consent or not. And it, as I said earlier, sometimes it's inadvertent, sometimes it's deliberate, but the technology has not kept up with the pace of regulatory change and the systems are far from bulletproof. So we have a problem today where companies intending to honor choice aren't really enabling that choice. So digital privacy has a component of actually being authentic once it's the choice is made.
John, do you have anything to add or modify to that?
Yeah, definitely agree. And when people build privacy systems, and I'm going to go back to privacy is the right to be left alone. And rather than the nihilism portion that we talked about a moment ago, there's the why do they need to know? Why do they get to know this stuff? And if it really is something that has what privacy engineers call transparency, consent, and control, which means I know what you're going to do with it. There was an affirmative action that I made saying that it was okay, and that I can go back at any time. So I control what gets used with things. Then it's not a bad thing. I mean, if I know what's going to be used, I know what somebody's collecting, I know what they're going to do with it, I can always say I don't want to do it after I affirmatively opted in, then why not get a free email account or a this or that something and you pay for it with your information? There's nothing wrong with paying for things with your information. The problem is that it's a black box. It is a cloud that no one can see in. We're in a fog about what we use. So that's the best way out of things, is to let us know what's going on so that we can really have an informed conversation between them and us.
You know, it's interesting. Dan, you brought up what companies are doing with information and whether they're being honest with the data and so on and so forth. As bad as companies are, I mean, like you said, Meta themselves just got fined 1.2 billion euros. Unfortunately, I don't think that really matters to Meta. They're kind of huge. My larger concern, and I think that what the audience probably doesn't realize, is the government's abuse of this data. Dan, can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, so there is a loophole in government collection of data in the Fourth Amendment, related to the Fourth Amendment, where there's a right against illegal search and seizure. However, if that data is purchased from a third party that happens to be a for-profit data broker, the government can use that data for its enforcement purposes, and that doesn't violate any laws. So it's a pretty big loophole when that happens. And when we look at where we are now, what the Dobbs ruling, the Supreme Court ruling last year, that really it was not just about abortion, it was about the sanctity of personal information, made it a lot easier and a lot more related to a lot more areas of enforcement when data about women's health was made available. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why we see the FTC action embracing healthcare, why Washington State passed My Health, My Data, which has been called the most significant privacy law since CCPA in 2018 in California to protect women's health. Because the ability for the government to access data about reproductive rights, to know where a woman was, what she was researching, what what her pregnancy state was, which is tracked in apps, creates a very powerful enforcement tool to enforce in states that curb the right to abortion. So we have both the mechanism, which is the procurement of data from private enterprise by the government, and we have some laws in certain areas that make it valuable for enforcement purposes to collect that data. And that, to me, is where the leaks that we see on the commercial side and some of the abuses on the commercial side really then can infringe on people's rights.
John?
Dan hit the thing that I was going to say, that there are improvements that we have had from the courts over privacy, that since roughly 2018 or 2014, the government needs a warrant to get into your cell phone and other devices. They also need a warrant to get things in specific, it was cell phone location data. However, they can go and they can buy it. So we need to have some sort of statement that says, if they need a warrant to collect it, collecting includes buying it on the open market. And that is a glaring loophole. And also, as what Dan said, there's healthcare now that is a constitutional right in California that is a felony in Texas. So what we have is a breakdown of the uniformity of state level protections. So that means that we have lots of things that are seemingly harmless that are potentially extraordinarily harmful now.
So, and I agree with you, but you know, the removal of the federal protection makes things very difficult. But on the other hand, and believe me, I don't think the government, I don't even like the census. Okay. So let me be very clear. I don't want the government to know anything at all for the most part. But that being said, if I consent to the terms and conditions, therefore, as I will be the product of Meta, and that's how they make their money, and part of that product collects this data as I have consented, and that terms and conditions states that they have a right to sell that data, what has the government actually done wrong?
Well, I'll add a point. I want to hear what John has to say to this, but I don't think that consent by individuals is really understood by individuals. There's research by Jennifer King out of Stanford that has found the average person really does not understand what their trade-offs are when they share data. And so relying on uneducated individuals who there is no training or education on privacy. It's something you have to pick up in your day-to-day life, and it's invisible. Same thing with data breaches, right? Why are there no riots for data breaches or privacy violations? Because they're invisible until something happens to you. You're safely going by, blissfully unaware of what's going on until something happens to you. And because of the invisibility, and because of the lack of understanding of what consent really means, I don't think it's appropriate to rely on a user to make an informed choice about their privacy, especially in the split second when that choice is presented to them, which is often the case in the digital world.
John?
Again, Dan's right. Informed consent is consent. There's also the aspect of it that we don't know what's going on, and things will happen later on that we didn't have a discussion about. There have been cases like, for example, in the family DNA testing things where they had reasonable privacy practices, then went into bankruptcy, and the information that they collected was an asset, and it was sold off, and it was considered that it was an asset, and the fact that people had consented meant that it could be sold, not that the constraints on the use had to be protected even in bankruptcy. So even in cases where people are trying to do the right thing, DNA data gets out, it gets used for other purposes, and people did not think of it. And the consent conversation even excluded those uses. So simple saying, well, you consented, which is the contract law aspect of these, that we put limits on what people can sign contracts to. There are illegal contracts. And those need to be part of what's going on, not just, well, you put your X at the bottom of the form, so therefore they can do anything they want.
So
I think, sorry, Jenny, if I could jump in there. I think
go ahead.
John raised a good point. And I want to go back, because I think the question you asked about, I have nothing to hide as a reason to not care about privacy, you really got to examine what, that's a point in time, a statement at a point in time. Financial difficulties, health difficulties, the data of your children who are unable to make their own choices and you need to make choices for them by law. Like, these are the areas where I really think you find that I have nothing to hide defense or rationale is very brittle.
So, Dan, you said something, and sort of John, but you said it first, was, you know, these people are largely uneducated in terms of what consent means and what can actually happen when they give that consent. I have a poke the bear comment, which I'll say in a moment, but how can we educate? Because at this point, and John, I'm sure that you've encountered this, there's a certain level of apathy about, especially with social media, right? There's a certain level of apathy about, let's take TikTok, okay? TikTok is a company owned by a foreign entity that is actually not allowed to operate in the country of its origin. Yet, it's allowed to operate here. And it's one of the, if not the fastest growing social media companies, you know, in the world, at least in the United States. And in fact, the United States is its primary, it's where its user base is. It's where, if you look at the TikTok demographics, they figured out how to make a whole bunch of people be stupid on TikTok. So how do we educate them? How do we make them care, or not, can't make them care, but how do we educate them so they hopefully will make a decision that allows them to care?
Which one of us first?
Yeah. I'm going to go with John, because I know John has experienced the apathy from a lot from the citizenry versus the business.
Okay, I'm going to smile as I say this, but I'm going to poke back, and every security privacy issue that we've talked about, they say, oh, we should educate people. And not only does education not work, but you run into the gray areas of, there are people who are educated, they know darn well, and they want to do it. So part of they're not educated is they have a different value system than we do. You know, they think that it's perfectly okay to spend their information for their entertainment. And so, you know, is it any different than when, like, you know, our parents accused us of wasting our money by putting it into arcade machines? you know, they're spending their thing the way that they want to, and they have the right to not agree with us. When we get to things like TikTok, TikTok's a social media thing. The narrative that we hear about all sorts of things is not accurate in its entirety, and it would take 10 minutes to make it go accurate. So let me just say, they're a social media company. They're not substantially different in abusive uses of information than other social media. And there's an awful lot of xenophobia around it. I mean, one of the reasons why they don't operate in China is that they offer more protections to people's privacy than the Chinese government wants. So, you know, that's part of the whole, it's more complex than you'd think. But the real issue is social media is collecting information about people. They're paying for it by using our information. That's why they're huge companies worth a lot of money. So that information is worth something. And people are making decisions about it. TikTok is the moral panic of the day, but it's been Snapchat, it's been Facebook, it's been, you know, MySpace, it's been all of these things. And there is the fact that human beings want to interact with other human beings. People like to be up on stage. Things like the 1-minute videos that TikTok did, it became popular because it was really attractive, not because there was some nefarious plan. It's that people wanted to do it. So think of it far more like it's the hot nightclub than anything else. There will be a day when it is not the hot nightclub, and the next thing will be, because that's also what goes on in social media.
Dan?
Yeah, John answered it better than I could. The discussion around TikTok, I think we could address that as more of a just as much a mental health topic as it is a privacy topic, because mm-hmm. that's really the core of what's wrong in my mind with social media. But I back to your question about how do we or can we educate individuals? I don't think we can. I don't think that is a fair expectation. I think the responsibility is on the companies that are purveying the practices, that companies that are even engaged in manipulative design or known as dark patterns. This is where we get into the deliberate, not the inadvertent privacy harms, but there are only now starting to become laws and rules against manipulative design, such as buttons to accept data sharing that are much bigger and much brighter than the buttons to decline data sharing. That kind of behavior is not only taking advantage of uneducated consumers, but it's also steering them in a direction that they otherwise would not have taken. So I am not generally a fan of big regulation until I really started to unpack this privacy issue. And I don't think you can rely on education of individuals in that moment to make the most educated choices. You've got to set a standard for company practices to follow.
I think that I would agree with that. Education is that is also a value system, right? Is to John's suggestion. I mean, just look at how people vote. Right. By far, the majority of people who vote, and it doesn't matter who you're voting for. You're not voting because you're educated on a particular idea. You're voting on a theory of an idea based on a color, red, blue, or whatever, green. Right. And you identify with that. You know, I vote Democrat because of X, or I vote Republican because of Y. And then you find out, oh, neither of them actually are X or Y, right? They were just trying to get elected. So I would agree to a certain point that education isn't going to work. But then at some point, and I can't believe I'm going to say this as a registered libertarian, at some point you have to have regulation, right? Because the companies, for-profit companies exist for one purpose: make money for shareholder. That's why they exist. That is the core function. Now, there are good companies out there. I like to think that my company is good. I like to think that Boltiv is good. And then, of course, there's good nonprofits like EFF. But we're all human, and everything I just said about being good is completely subjective. Mm. All three of us will sit in a room and talk about privacy all day long. Largely probably won't disagree too much, unless we're trying to, like, flesh out an argument. But I can literally walk down the street and have another discussion. And like I said, you know, why does it matter to me? And you say, John, you said the nihilism part. And then we also got into the education part of that argument. But And John, or I mean, excuse me, Dan, I'm going to have you address this if you're comfortable addressing it. But I'm going to, I wasn't the one that said I have nothing to hide. But I do understand the argument, because when you say, like, John, you brought up doxing and releasing of addresses and things like that. For me, who I am, bring it on. I you can't fire me. I'm not going to lose customers. I mean, you might be a pain in my ass, but other than that, I mean, I've got all the credits, all the credit scores locked down, all my, you know, but I am also not your normal person when it comes to that skill set or that education. Dan, if you're comfortable, would you, you touched on it briefly in your intro. Can you share how, what directly affected you? How that, why this is such a big deal? Because I think it will resonate better with someone who is not like John or myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. your life is fine until it's not, until something private happens that changes your worldview. And that has permanently changed myself and my children, the loss of my wife to cancer. And that in the framing of, I was a marketer for much of my career. Whereas I wouldn't have engaged in the abuses that we're talking about, I had a different mindset, which was data is there to be monetized. Data is serving a commercial purpose. And there, for years and decades, there was no counterbalance to that point of view. And others took it to greater extremes than I did. But my world was flipped around when I saw data that was highly, highly personal and painful being used in a way to sell things to me and to us that not only we didn't want, but that would actually be harmful. I mean, there's a lot of shady therapies out there, and there's a lot of money being made in the healthcare space. So that it's a kind of two parts to this issue. One is the release of information, whether it's related to health or financial status, or for others, it can be sexual orientation or other private things that they don't want shared at that moment. But then the other part is, what do you receive? That's what the world is taking from you. What is the world giving back to you? And in my personal experience, there were things that we didn't want and things that actually made the experience even more invasive and abusive and predatory. So that mindset change, which I hope people don't go through, but many do, will change your mind when something private that you don't want known about you happens to you.
So Dan, can you, you said predatory. What is an example of that predatory behavior? I have one in mind, but.
Yeah. Well, let's use a more universal example, COVID-19, the peddling of silver colloidal, I think was one of the treatments. Right. Predatory, meaning you find someone in a vulnerable state. In this case, it happened to be most of the world. But with the technologies that exist in the internet, you would be able to pinpoint those that are more worried, those are more concerned, and those who are maybe less educated on what the proper treatments are. That predatory means taking advantage of someone's lack of understanding and the condition that they're in, the vulnerable condition that they're in, to sell them something that can be harmful to them. Or even if it's not harmful to them, it's something that they wouldn't have purchased in a more steady state of mind. That's
snake
the predatory
oil.
Aspect. Yeah, snake oil back, right. Right, to go a century earlier, exactly.
John, what are your thoughts here?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that you were saying is, in fact, that you're smart, you're educated, you're prepared, you've done a lot of work on this. Just like I know people who are really good at finance. I'm not really good at finance. I know I'm not, which is why, you know, it's like you take care of things by finding experts for you. We all have things that we're good at, and we all have things that we're not good at. And by collecting a lot of information, they can start figuring out what you're manipulatable on. You know, as an example, where I'm going to slightly change the subject, I'm a photographer, and those of us who like cameras talk about a disease that we call gear acquisition syndrome, which is that you always want to buy the next new thing. And darn straight, you can be manipulated to buy something you didn't really need, no matter who it is, no matter who you are. You know, it's like, I know people who are perfectly upfront about their yarn addiction. I know people who are upfront about these other things. And it really is, they're taking advantage of things to get your money from you. And that's what we're dealing with here. Is that level of manipulation, which is financial. When we get to things like, oh, I don't have anything to hide, and I say, well, we all do, there was a not scientific survey where some people who were privacy activists said, oh, you don't have anything to hide, and sort of a person on the street thing. Let me look into your phone. And they would find that, like, small business owners had the passcode to their store sitting in their phone. They would find all of these other things. We all got this little stuff lying around that includes passwords to our bank accounts, so on and so forth. We all got things to hide, and we're getting better at putting them into password managers and so on, but it's all out there, and where are the limits? There is the small L libertarian, the government should be as small as possible aspect, which, you know, is certainly a good one. But I like CCPA. I like GDPR. I know that many of the things that you might come back and say, oh, but what about the thing that is at the bottom? They don't have to do it that way. It's what Dan was talking about with dark patterns. They're making it so that they want to trick you into, after having said, no, I don't want this, to accidentally, because you're in a hurry, revoke that again and say, okay, you can have that. So we need to have these rules. And I, you know, I can talk about other ones like biometric privacy laws. Illinois's got a fantastic biometric privacy law. And I can tell you about the sorts of things that have been active situations if you want me to, but I'll hand it back to you and Dan for a moment.
Okay. So we agree that education isn't going to work. We agree that, I mean, even I said it, that it, there might be need to be some regulation. Dan, you also mentioned that it's kind of on the companies. I would say that those that don't pay attention to history are doomed to repeat it. Therefore, it can't be on the companies. I mean, there is not a decade that doesn't go by where there isn't a private entity that isn't destroying their the people that are buying their product. Whether it be, I mean, pop culture reference, the Aaron Brockovich movie, right? True story. That's just a simple one, right? They were literally killing people. So that means that it has to be the people that make the change. How do we get the people to make the change? And I mean, the argument there is obviously the government is by the people for the people. I don't agree that that's how it operates in day-to-day life, but in general. So what is it that we can do? I mean, Dan, why you say it's up to the companies, but how can we rely on that?
Yeah, when I say it's up to the companies, I mean, it's the accountability lies with the companies. The responsibilities with the regulators and the lawmakers to put pressure on the companies to set those rules that companies need to abide by. Because companies left to their own devices, as John was saying, will find their way into profits. And they're, I believe it was John who said this. So we need laws. And you know what? We need lawsuits too, which is somewhat of a controversial point, that there's an argument about whether a private right of action is really necessary in privacy, or can we just leave it up to the departments of justice and the various jurisdictions to keep up. I think we need lawsuit pressure too, but that's the pressure on the companies. It's the, if you do not follow, there are going to be painful costs that are actually going to hit the bottom line. Now, then you get into an argument about, okay, if you believe that laws are the answer, which I believe they are in this situation, well, what kinds of laws? Should they be at the local level or should they be at the national level? And this is another area where others may disagree with me, but I don't believe a national law is going to get us there. I actually believe that, sadly as it is, the patchwork we're seeing within the states is going to be the most likely path to getting to compliance. Why do I say this? Is if you look at the history of federal laws, like the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, or the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, these things will sit around for 40 or 50 years without being changed. And if you want to wonder how much the world changes in 40 or 50 years, imagine how much the world has changed in the past year with generative AI alone, right? There's technological changes that the federal government is incapable of keeping up with. So a national law, in my opinion, isn't going to get us there. It's going to become stale within 6 months of it being passed. So then what do? You go to the states, and that's exactly what's happening right now. Similar to cybersecurity, where breach notification laws went state by state. I think California was the first, and after 15 years, you had 50 of them. Same thing is happening in privacy. California was the first, and after 5 years, we have 10 states. As we record this, Texas just passed in its legislature a privacy law in Texas yesterday, which is, now we're talking about a red state, and we're talking about a blue state, California and Texas, which together represent 20% of the U.S. population just in those two states. It needs to happen at the state level. If you observe what Colorado has done with rulemaking, what California has done with rulemaking, these laws are organic. They change as circumstances change, unlike the federal level. Yes, it does make it difficult for companies to comply, but the horn of software vendors like us, that's what technology does. It allows you, just like different states have different taxes, you can use technology to come up with a common denominator or a high watermark for privacy state by state. So short answer to your question, I think the answer is laws. I think they're best at the state level, not the federal level. And I believe having that sharp elbow of lawsuits is what gets companies to take action, because you can't just hide in the herd when it's when there are lawsuits that class actions can spring up that will hold companies accountable.
John, what are your thoughts?
At EFF, we're big fans of private right of action and pound our fist on the table saying that that needs to be part of it, because that is the place where everyday people get to push back and convince people that they shouldn't do that to begin with because they're going to get sued. And that is one of the primary enforcement mechanisms that really works really well. I agree with Dan on things where we need to have more privacy laws. My place where I would disagree is that having a national law that sets a floor, not a ceiling. This is kind of one of the debates that goes on about laws is, mm-hmm. does the law mandate a minimum that you can't go below or mm-hmm. a maximum that you can't go above? Mm-hmm. The federal proposed privacy laws that have been around and they're still going on now have had the problems with them that they didn't include private right of action and that they were ceilings, not floors. Most recently, they were ceilings with cutouts. So, for example, they'd say, oh, you can't have more than this. But okay, you people in Illinois, you people in California, we're not going to cut yours back. But none of the rest of you get to be as good as Illinois or California. Mm-hmm. And you know, doesn't that tell you something? Doesn't that tell you something?
So, John, can you do me a favor? Can you define private right of action?
That means that individuals, groups can sue on their own. That Dan said it. It's whether or not the FTC can take an action or whether a person can take an action. As an example, let's go to Illinois because we talked about this. The case that went up was that there was an amusement park that had a fast track go through to do things where they took your fingerprints. And some parents dropped their kids off at the amusement park. The kids all did the fast use your fingerprint to get onto the ride thing. And the parents said, what the hell? And it went to the Illinois Supreme Court, who said, oh, yeah, you guys can sue. Yeah, absolutely. And that's a private right of action where parents who are upset about the way that their kids were mistreated are causing real effect for everybody in the state.
Okay. So I actually agree with both of you when it comes to how this is going to be solved, and I have practical examples. I do agree that the laws need to start at the states. There's a number of reasons for that, in that one of them is the states have rights, right? They're not, we are not one envelope of single culture. Every state has a different culture. Some of them don't even speak English, even though they think they do, right? And a good, you know, here are some very simple examples of where states making laws are good and that are also leading to changes nationally, which I think will also end up over time being federal. Cannabis is an example of states taking over, and it's actually one of the most direct middle fingers to the federal government, because the federal government says it's illegal, and we have, I don't know, 27 states or something like that at this point that are like, no, this is ridiculous. If you're going to allow people to drink tequila, for God's sakes, they can have some cannabis. So cannabis is a good example. Right to action, there's an interesting problem there, private right to action, when you start talking about firearms and people that are suing firearm manufacturers. So that's the flip side of whether or not they should have that action. But one that's actually close to my heart, there's a lot of things California does that I really don't like, but there is one thing that they are very, very good at, and that is animal welfare. So the laws that they've made about pork and about chicken, and I'm a huge meat eater, but the laws that they've said, look, these animals, this livestock, you will treat humanely until the point that they're harvested, right? That's a good thing. And what's great, especially with California in like the pork laws and the chicken laws, you know, as a lot of my listeners know, and you guys know, I travel 6-7 months a year, and we go state to state. We're trying to buy local. But now what, on this last trip, we started to see things like, this was actually chickens from California that I was buying in Arizona, the eggs. And therefore I knew that I was getting chickens that had a reasonable living condition to the point where they provided me with sustenance. Now pork's a little bit of a different problem for me. It's not a problem. Pork's different for me because we just buy our pigs whole right here, locally from homesteaders. But you know, the idea, I can't remember the exact numbers, but you know, California consumes, you know, 30% of the nation's pork and only produces like 8% or something like that, which is why people were upset. But those kinds of laws, those laws permeate. When you start seeing, like you, Dan, you said Texas and California, when you start talking about 20%, and then you get someone like New York, all of a sudden you've got almost 50% of the nation covered by all walks of ideology that are agreeing that this has to change. And what it does is it, in my mind, provides a framework for the federal government to actually implement something that makes sense. So from that perspective, I agree with you, Dan. But John, I also agree with you that in the end, it's got to be federal. There are certain laws that just have to be federal. You know, concealed carry permits. It's ridiculous that as someone who has a concealed carry permit in Washington cannot conceal carry in Oregon. Right? It doesn't make sense. So there, that at some point needs to be a federal law. The animal welfare. And in this case, a U.S. – and I can't stand the GDPR because I think they just – they compromise too much. But a U.S.-based GDPR, right? Just a floor, like you said, John, a floor that says you just can't do X. Right. But let me ask you this. What is that floor, John? What do you think is an acceptable floor for, you know, this is just the way it is?
I'm going to want the floor higher than lots of people are going to. And you are, too. And the reason why we would want to have the sort of conversation that you're talking about, where we both have things that are local, you know, where states are local, and we have them as federal, is so that we as a culture get to decide what portions of it we like and where we don't want to have it. So I certainly, You know, it's like, if you want me to do things like, I don't think that CCPA went as far as it should have in a bunch of places, but, you know, it's not a bad law and we can improve things later. Europe tends to govern differently than we do, and they tend to look at things from a rights standpoint as opposed to more of a contract standpoint. So their model of how they think about things is different. We're similar to the EU in that the EU and the United States are very similar, where there are sovereignties under the whole that get to do a lot of things that they want. And there are differences, like, you know, here in the US, we have things like the Interstate Commerce Clause, and we have things where the federal government gets to do international relations and states do not. But in Europe, those are different. And similarly to what you're talking about, where you have differences between states, you have differences between the way that Europe looks at things and the way that US looks at things, and the way that other places like Japan and so on will look at things, where internationally we'll get to an agreed upon framework about the way that these things work by permitting and acting upon local differences, where you find out that people over there care about things that people over there do not care about. And we let them make decisions like that.
So, you know, in a practical mindset, would the floor be you cannot collect without explicit consent?
Absolutely. Explicit opt-in consent.
Opt-in, yeah.
Opt-in.
Okay.
You know, I'm going to go back to transparency, consent, and control. You got to be able to opt out. You got to be able to do things like, say, delete my data. You got to be able to know what it is being used for and be able to change things when times change, so that you stop things like, in a bankruptcy, the data is not merely considered to be an asset that gets sold as if it was like office furniture. Those are all the ways that the data that they collect needs to be treated not merely like a thing, because it is about other humans.
Dan?
The elements that I would like to see in laws and regulations, is that the question?
Yeah.
Fundamental.
What's your floor?
My floor is dark patterns need to be covered, dark signals need to be covered, and sensitive data needs to be covered. And what I mean by those is, so dark patterns, we've already talked about, that's manipulative design. And I don't believe you're going to be able to educate users out of making split second choices they later regret. Dark signals is more on the companies, where once the consent choice is made, and this is what Boltiv has discovered on a regular basis, that those signals, those bits and bytes get lost in a daisy chain of technical handoffs, vendor to vendor to vendor, that causes degradation of the signal and loss in many cases, 25 to 50% of the time, of the opt-out consent. So dark signals need to be part of the law as well. That is, you are obligated to authentically pass on and honor the signal from a consumer if they've chosen to opt out. And the third is sensitive data, whereas I don't know if I 100% agree with John about a fundamental universal opt-in. I do believe with sensitive data, opt-in needs to be the express choice, that the default is an opt-out for sensitive data, because of what we've seen happen with health and children's data, race, religion, sexual orientation, all those aspects. Those are areas where I would think the default should be an opt-out. And I'm just a little bit leery of a opt-in requirement for all forms of data, because I don't know the cascading commercial impact and how many businesses would lose their livelihood and what the impact to individuals in the economy would be if it goes that far. But to me, a floor would be dark signals, dark patterns, and special protections for sensitive data. And maybe I'll add a fourth one just because, private right of action, for the reasons that John and I stated earlier.
Okay, so you brought up something that it made me realize. But first, Dark, I want to, we're running a little short on time here, but I do want to talk about dark patterns. I think dark signals is probably a little bit longer conversation, but you say that dark patterns are manipulation. That's marketing, right? So what is it that makes it evil, right? What is wrong with me having a page as a form and I say the opt-in button is green, which makes people, they'll lean toward hitting it, versus the opt-out, which would be red, right? Why is that
necessary? It's deceptive because it's deceptive and abusive, and that's not only a legal standard, but I think it's an ethical standard. When you throw barriers up in front of people to make one choice and clear the pathway for them to make another choice that is not in their best interest, and it's not just privacy, it's also commerce. So there was a common practice about 15, 20 years ago, where when you go to a shopping cart, you'd have default checkboxes for things that you didn't know you were buying, and they'd be buried, they'd be hidden, and they would add on to the price, and they were placed right around where the sales taxes were, so they'd get easily hidden. And you were paying for things that you didn't want, and then you'd be provided a service that you had no intention because you couldn't see it. So to me, the difference isn't just marketing. It's when you throw barriers up, when you hide things that an individual in a normal situation wouldn't be able to see, that steers them towards something that causes them to lose their privacy or lose some of their money because they didn't know that they were buying something. And I like back to what John said before, we may be paying with money or we may be paying with our data privacy, but when that's manipulated and when that's something you didn't intend to do, then that to me, that's unethical.
Well, I would agree, but it's also subjective, right? Ethics are totally subjective. And that becomes an issue. For the audience, one of the ways, you know, we talked about how the opt-in or the opt-out, it kind of gets lost through the chain. Here's a very, and correct me, guys, if you disagree with this, but this is a very simple way that I have seen this in my life. And I'm not going to say which publications, but I will go in, I have, you know, like a lot of us, we have our throwaway Gmail account that is used for crap. Okay. And I will go in and I will unsubscribe. Actually, I'll list one. Nextdoor is a perfect example of this. I will unsubscribe from everything. A couple weeks later, I suddenly start getting the emails again. Nextdoor, I didn't go opt in again. They probably bought some data that at some point said that I opted in at some point somewhere for certain kind of information. And so I start getting those emails again. Would that be an example of what you were talking about?
Yeah, I think the mechanism behind that with Nextdoor is a little, the outcome is the same, but I think the mechanism is a little bit different. But what I've observed Nextdoor do is they have very narrow, discrete categories of opt-outs. So whereas you think you're opting out of emails in general, you're opting out of the category of event emails, and you're still going to get other categories of emails from Nextdoor unless you uncheck all of those. That's been my experience with Nextdoor. Yes, it's possible that they could discover another email for you that wasn't the throwaway Gmail account and they can reach you that way. But I think there's multiple ways that happens. And technically it's correct. You didn't, you know, when I've tried to opt out of Nextdoor, I didn't opt out of everything like I thought I did. And so I had to go back several times to get it right.
John, I'd like to ask you this question. I mean, Dan, and you can obviously reply too. It has to do with kids. Now, we talked about how sensitive data that's the floor, right? Period, the end. You don't, whether it be your religion, basically, I would argue anything that you have rights to, right? You have a right to religion. You have a right to bear arms. It's nobody's business what your sexual orientation is, you know. That's blocked off. A more important concern to me, I mean, my kids actually, as of last week, all of my kids can now be charged as adults. But before then, honestly, when we talk about privacy and social media and kids, to me, the problem is simple. It should be illegal for a child to sign up for any social media, period, the end, without consent of the parent, period. The parent has to know, right? If the fact that a child can go on and have the account mom watches me on, and then the account I talk to all my friends on, And then the account that my secret boyfriend is on, or girlfriend. And then the account that I watch porn on. And it's all legal because they're over 13 or 14. Now, not the porn one, but you know what I'm saying? Would that be a baseline as parent, as grown-ass men who may or may not have children, but have children, I'm sure, in their lives that they care about? Is that a reasonable, like, solution to some of these problems? Not all of it, because some parents just don't care, right? They're like, please, God, put them on Instagram so they leave me alone. What you're pointing. What do you – go ahead, John. Oh, John, your mic's off.
Sorry.
It's okay.
No, I was pointing because, you know, you're making a very good point there, but one of the issues, particularly when it comes to children, is that it is not a hard line. There is a very different thing between a 17-year-old and a 12-year-old.
True.
There, and it is a separate issue that we would bring up children so that they can do nothing until the day that they can then do everything and they haven't been educated about it. You have to be able to do things like that. And we already have the strongest privacy protections for children under 12 in the US. Now, what that means is that all of the websites say you have to be 13 or older, and every kid who's 12 years old signs up for social media anyway, often with their parents' consent that it wasn't allowed, but, you know, it's like, here's what's going anyway. And it is an overly simplistic way to do things. There's also the issue of, even if I accept the sorts of things that you're talking about, how would you implement that? Do you want to implement it so that there's age checks everywhere? Do you want to make it so that there's age checks plus a biometric check everywhere? Do you want to have face recognition of age estimation on cameras everywhere for every website? That's what you're asking for. That's what you're asking for, dude.
I think you could interpret it that way. The other way to interpret it is assume that everyone's a child, and that sounds extreme, but
that's most
you could
voters.
Also give the best protection, right? Give, you know, parental consent could be a little bit unwieldy if you're talking about a 45-year-old or older, but give the best protections and don't bicker whether they're 13 or 14 or 15 or 17. Just give the best protections. And I think we see the laws moving in that direction by default. So COPPA was the rule that established under 13, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, I think it was in 2000. Now, CCPA raised it to 16. COSA, the Kids Online Safety Act, which is being considered in Congress, raises it to 17. The California Age Appropriate Design Code Act, which is modeled after the UK, which takes effect in July next year, that sets the definition of a child is under 18. I think the laws are literally raising the bar on what constitutes a child. And I think that's a good thing. Don't worry. Just make the right choice and assume that the person is a child. If they're viewing 10th grade educational content, there's actually a discussion that came up with a client today. If they're viewing 10th grade educational content, assume they're a child. Like, don't try to split hairs on that. I think with children, we need to create more blanket protections.
All right. So I want to say one final thing to let it percolate in your heads, because I think we kind of might have an interesting next episode just by this topic right here. But before I say that, is there anything that you guys, John, that you would like to add before we close out?
Going to what we were just talking about, I am really afraid of the present generation of protect the children things, because they're all incredibly badly designed and they're going to lead us straight to a surveillance society. And they're in many cases absolutely impossible to follow the law if you wanted to anyway. And that we could talk for another few hours on that. So So what I'm going to say is that we need to have some combination of policy controls, which are, you know, norms, laws, etc., regulations, and also technology to do them. There's technologies that you can get that will help you produce things. We talked about trackers before. I mean, you know, it's like we at EFF make Privacy Badger, which is a tracker blocker. There are our tracker blockers built into a number of other browsers. We're making progress on those sorts of things. We need more technological things because they work. I mean, that was one of the things that when we got to confidentiality / privacy through encryption was that we made technologies that actually worked, and we're still debating those right now too. But we also have to have rules. And the combination of those is useful because each does something well and each does something poorly. And I'll hand it to Dan.
No, that I can't close with anything better than what John said, but I guess I would say the listeners for your following here, JD, are going to be the ones that are educating themselves. And I would just say, think about your privacy when you make choices about the businesses you patronize. And just like we take a moment before we enter our credit card information to an unfamiliar site, take a moment when you're presented with an unfamiliar site before you just accept all that the regulations will provide some help, but really the best help we can provide to ourselves is not being on autopilot as much of the time, stepping off of autopilot for a moment to make the right privacy choices when we encounter a medium for the first time.
Well, I agree with both of you. The thought process in my head would be the movie ratings, right? You've got G, PG, PG-13, R, NC-17, and then of course X. Although I think NC-17 and X are kind of the same thing now, but there might be something worth exploring there. And in fact, before the internet was the Wild West, you had things like AOL or Prodigy where you could go in and you could say, this is my kid's account, and boom, 98% of it was gone. They had filters on words automatically and things like that. I think there might be opportunity to kind of consider that, especially from a self-regulating standpoint, if we can get the big guys to act, you know, just like the movie industry. It's not a, you know, whether it's getting to PG or PG-13, as I understand, it's not a federal thing. It's a movie industry thing. There might be opportunity there to protect everyone, not just kids, but everyone, because there's plenty of people out there that will say to themselves, I'm a grown man, but I don't watch rated R movies. I know a few of them. It's just, it's their value set. And with that, this has been More Than a Refresh Presents on Digital Privacy. John Callis with Director of Public Interest Technology at Electronic Frontier Foundation. And Dan Freshling, CEO at Boltiv. Thank you, guys. That was fantastic.